We're starting here on the bottom of Yud-Tet Amud Bet, 10 lines up from the bottom. Tanu Rabbanan, Shnayim Chatumim Al Ashtar, Umeitu. Two people are signed on a shtar, and they passed away. Bashnayim Min Ashuk, two other people, independent individuals come along. Vamru Yadanu, Shaktav Yadamhu. We know that this is their handwriting. Aval Anisimayu, but they were under duress when they signed it. Kitanimayu, or they were minors. Psulei Edutayu, or they were problematic. Harielu Nemanim, they are believed. Here again, because of the principle of Pesha Asur, Pesha Hitir, the only reason we know that the signatories to this shtar are okay, we have verification of it, is because of these Edim. So since they are verifying it, they can also qualify the statement by which they are verifying it. If we have alternate Edim that say that this is the handwriting of these Edim, if we have their handwriting or their signatures from another document about which there were some questions, and Beit Din checked it out, so there is verification from an independent document for their signatures, then they're not believed anymore because we are not relying on them anymore to be makzik the shtar. The shtar exists without their testimony. Then they don't have a right to come along and then testify to take away the nemanut of these edim. These edim have a chazakah in a sense that they were believed when they signed the document. When they signed the document, they were ksherim. We saw all the chazakot in the past dapim that a person who signs a document is usually a gadol. A person who signs a document checks it out, or the malveh checks out to make sure that they are gidolim. So the assumption is that the edim are good. If we find their signature somewhere else, and we know that these are the Edim, and there's no forgery over here, that we're going to believe, and we're going to assume that the document is okay. In the previous part, the only reason we discarded the document is because these Edim, Toch de Dibur, said that the star is good, but, and that but undermines everything that they said before. So now, on the other hand, when you have Edim, they'll come along and verify it independently, these Edim carry no weight anymore, because you have Edim verifying the star. Plus, on top of that, you have chazokot that these edim are good. Umagbi and beik kibishtar amalio, and therefore you can collect with it like a regular shtar. The Gemara says, "Vamai, why is that? Why are we discarding the idut of these individuals? Trei utrei ninhu. It's 2 versus 2. You have 2 edim saying good shtar, 2 edim saying bad shtar. That's 2 versus 2. Why shouldn't we consider the idut of those that are saying that it's pasul?" Okay, we're not going to say automatically it's pasul, but we should actually give them some consideration over here. They're still really edim, so why don't we consider what they're saying versus the others that are saying that it's a good shtar? Samar Rav Sheshet, Zoto Merit. From this, you would conclude, whether Rav Sheshet himself might hold of this is not necessarily relevant. It's just Rav Sheshet said, if I read this, this is what I conclude. Hachasha tchila tazamahi. That if you have a conflict, the conflict is the beginning of hazama. Now, hachasha versus hazama are two different forms of edut where edim could disagree. Hachasha is where edim disagree about the facts of the case or whatever the incident was. They disagree about that. They don't testify about each other. They testify about the case itself. And their testimony disagrees in whatever way. There's some sort of discrepancy between the edut. That's called hachasha. Other than hazama is gzerat hakatuv, which is that a second of edim come along and say, they don't talk about the facts of the case, they simply discredit the edim. They discredit the edim by saying, imanu aitem. You were with us at that time. There's no way you can testify about this case because you were with us in a different location when you're testifying about this. That's gzerat hakatuv, that the second of edim are believed, and the first edim are subject to the punishment of a karzer zamam nasod achiv. Whatever they wanted to impose through their testimony, they will be subject to that punishment. So that's hazama. What the Gemara here says, that hachosha tchila tazamahi, that when there is this type of disagreement on the facts of the case, that is almost the first step towards hazama of these edim. And these edim, ukashem, shem izimim et edim el bifnehem. And just like you cannot disqualify these edim by saying imanu aitem unless they are there to defend themselves, so too, you can't discredit the edim in terms of their facts. That there's a discrepancy in the facts here, except if you are in front of them. Over here, the Edim on the Shtar are dead. They're not here. So when these other Edim come along and say they were Psulim, they were so-and-so, they were such-and-such, they have no way to defend themselves. We have no other side here that comes along and allows them to defend themselves. So they're not believed over here because they have a requirement to do it in front of them. And since they're not around, how can you discredit Edim who can't defend themselves? Hazama requires that the Edim be present that you're trying to discredit. So if you're going to speak about these Edim, you have to speak in front of them. So what Rav Sheshet says is that Al-Khasha has a touch of Hazama in it. And so too, if you want to have a discrepancy in the facts of the case, and discredit the Edim from that perspective, you also have to have them in front of you so they can defend themselves. Those that are signed on the Shtar are gone. They're not here anymore. We have their signatures showing up in different places. There's no reason for us to allow you to come and discredit these Edim by saying this when they can't defend themselves. So now Amar Rav Nachman, Ilu Hava Kaman, if the Edim that signed on the Shtar were present, Omachshin Lehu, and then they disagreed, there was a discrepancy in the Edut, Hava Chasha, then we would have said that there was a lock here between the two sets of Edim. We're unable to determine, meaning that they're disagreeing. The Edim on the Shtar are disagreeing with these Edim are coming along. Edim on the Shtar say, we were Kasher Edim. The Edim are coming along and say, you weren't Kasher Edim. That's Edut HaChasha. And if they were present, those Edim from the Shtar, we would say, okay, we're now hung between these two sets of Edim, and the case is locked. V'lova mashkechim bohu. Tavloi Edut Mocheshet. Over there, we wouldn't have listened to the Edim who signed on the Shtar because it's an Edut Mucheshet. Hashta Delitnehu. Now that they're not present, Tila Bekaman, Dilma Ava Moduluhu. And if the Edim were present, maybe they would have agreed and said, we were Psule Edut. Mehemne, you're going to believe them? So you're actually giving them more power now that they passed away than if they were alive. If they were alive, and these Edim came and said they were Psule Edut, they were Ktanim, and the Edim who signed on the Shtar said, no, we weren't. We would say it's Edut Mucheshet, and you wouldn't be able to collect with this Shtar. Now that they're dead, the Edim, all of a sudden they have more power, so that if you come and disagree with them, you can't disagree with them. Why should they have more power when they're dead than when they're alive? And Rav Nachman says, you have another side to this story. You keep thinking about the story from this perspective. If they were alive, they would defend themselves against these claims and say they were right. Maybe if they were alive, they would say, you're right. We were Psule Edut. We worked on him. They could have agreed with these Edim. So there's two sides to this puzzle. You can't automatically assume that these Edim are Kshirim, and that's what they would defend if they were present. If they were present, they might have agreed with these Edim. Therefore, Rav Nachman says, Rav Nachman, Uki Tre the Hadi Tre. You do have a stalemate over here. 2 versus 2. Vuki Mamona Bechezkat Marei. And then we follow Chazaka. Meaning in the case where you have Edim that are stalemated, then you go after another, you need some other Machriya. What's the Machriya over here? Chazaka. Who has the money? Money is with the hands of the Lofe over here. Since he has the money, we're not going to make him pay the Malve with the questionable Shtar. So the Chazaka of the money remains with the Lofe. And therefore, we will not validate the Shtar. The only problem is we had a Braita before. The Braita before said that Nemanim, they are believed. So what do you do with that fact? If you have Edim that come along afterwards and they say that they discredit these Edim, we said they are Nemanim. So Rashi asked the question over here, the Braita that says Ne'emanim, what are they Ne'eman about? How could they be Ne'eman if you really have here a stira, a stalemate between the Edim, and the stalemate produces a conclusion that we follow the Chazakah, so then why should there be any issue of Ne'emanim? So Rashi says, Uktani bebraita in Ne'emanim, that they are believed or not believed, lo de la havi shtara ma'alyo, l'mik bebe, we concluded before, when we said they were Ne'eman or in Ne'eman, it was whether the star was valid or not valid. Is this a valid star? Is it not a valid star? Rashi says, that's not the way to read it. Ella delo karinanle. We don't rip it up based on their testimony. So that's number one. Rashi says, what we'll do is we'll leave the star intact. If we believe these Edim, we would rip up the star. These Edim come along and say, these were Psule Edut. They were Ktanim. They were Anusim. They're under duress. We'd rip the star up and say, this is an invalid star. Rip it up. Otherwise, someone's going to try to collect with it. But now that we say, Einam ne'emanim, they're not believed. Rav Nachman says they are believed. We're stalemated and we go by chazakah. So what does it mean they're not believed? They're not believed that we don't rip up the shtar. The shtar remains in case we get more evidence in the case because we don't know now. And then Rashi brings a second nafkamina. He says, v'itofis, if the malve grabbed some property, v'adarati hai v'tovamine, now the love is trying to get it back from the malve, lo mafkinim, we won't take it away from him because The shtar is intact, and who has the chazaka now? The malva has the chazaka, he has the money. So Rashi says there are two nafkaminot. One is we don't rip up the shtar, and number two is if the malva was tofes, then we can't get the money back. The lova is the one stuck now because the chazaka is with the malva who's holding the money. And because of that, the lova will be unable to take away the money. Tosfot over here speaks about this idea of tfisa, which is controversial amongst the Rishonim, because Tosfot says that you can only be tofes when there's no safek. But if there's a safek in your toe-face, we're going to take the money back. Because if the Edim already showed up in Beit Din and the Malva grabbed the money, he grabbed the money in the face of a safek, and now you can't claim there's a chazakah that he had the money, because when he took it, there was already a question about whether he's entitled to it. So Tosfot says maybe you can't be toe-face, or maybe he was toe-face before the safek happened. He did it prior to the testimony of these Edim, and now we can't upend it. Or the quotes Darash Bo says that this is a case where there's a shover. There's some sort of receipt that we're dealing with here, and therefore you can be oki mamona mechezgat marei, might be towards the malvis side versus the lovis side, because we have a receipt that there was payment over here. There are always different ways to slice the pie over here. And talk about tfisa. Some say if they're edim, tfisa b'makum edim doesn't count. Some say here that edim don't count because there's a chasha. But Rashi at least entertains or tries to help us understand what's going on in the Braita. What is Naaman and Einaaman if, according to Rav Nachman, the Edim carry no weight here. They're stalemated. So Rashi says there are nafkaminot, even in a stalemated case, as to what you do with the shtar, as well as what you do with tfisa. And that's what the outcome of this braita is. Now, the Gemara says, Midel havi anichsei bar shatya, because this is similar to the case of someone who is not of sound mind, and he's selling his property. The bar shatya zaven nichsei, he sold his property to someone. Atu beitre amrei kushu shote zavin. They come along and testify he was not of sound mind when he sold his property. The other two come along and say that he was healthy at the time. He was totally of sound mind when he sold the property. You have to now give a stalemate in terms of the edut because you have two against two. And therefore, who has the chazak on the property? The seller here, who is the parshatya, the person who is not of sound mind. He supposedly sold the property. Now the buyer wants to come and get the property from him. Who's muhzak in the property? The barshatya. He still has the property. So we're not going to move the property based on a stalemated edut. But you have a chasha here. So the property stays with the barshatya because he is the muhzak in the property. V'lo amran el de'itle chazoko davate. That's only true if the property was a yerusha to him, meaning he inherited the property. And his establishment of ownership is because he inherited it. Because then there's a real chazaka here. About lately chazaka davate, if he doesn't have the chazaka of his father, amrin in kashushotezavan, that he bought it when he was a shoteh, and he sold it when he was a shoteh. You can't create the chazaka. You can't say that, oh yeah, he was healthy when he brought the property, and now he's a shoteh when he sold the property. Whatever state of being he was in, when he sold the property, that's probably likely the state of being he was in when he bought the property. We don't know. I mean, if we have Edim that when he bought the property he was of sound mind, then there'd be no question he could establish a chazaka. The problem is that we don't know. This guy goes in and out of being of sound mind or not. So now we have testimony versus the last sale where he sold the property, and they're arguing about whether he was of sound mind when he sold the property. But he also bought the property, and we have no idea what his status or state of mind was then. We're going to assume whatever his state of mind is when he sold the property, that was his state of mind when he bought the property. If that's the case, he can't establish a chazaka on the property. Because if he was of sound mind when he bought the property, and he established a chazaka, then he's probably of sound mind when he sold the property, and then the bokeach really bought it. On the other hand, if he was not of sound mind when he sold the property, he probably was also not of sound mind when he bought the property, and that means he never established a chazaka. In that case, there isn't a chazaka on the land. The assumption is that this person has always been in this state of being. Because when a person is going in and out of being of sound mind, the Gemara here assumes that that was their ailment or that was a sickness that persisted. If we know for sure that he was healthy earlier, then there's nothing to talk about. If this ailment or this sickness, illness only came about much later on, then we would assume that the property was bought properly. This is only with the assumption this has been a lifelong challenge for him. He goes in and out of being of sound mind. If we don't know better, we assume yet that it's always been this way. If we know better, then we'll deal with it. Meaning that the assumption is that whatever the state of a person's being right now is, that's where all he was, unless we can prove otherwise. So people know that he was healthy at some point, then fine, then we know that. But if we don't, we assume whatever the state of being is now was always the state of being. That whenever we find something now, we assume that that was its permanent state unless we can bring evidence to the contrary. So here, if he now goes in and out of being of sound mind, we assume that that was the way he was for time and memorial. Unless, again, if we have evidence to the contrary, that's fine. Then we don't have to worry about it. But if we don't have evidence to the contrary, whatever his status is today was always the way that he was. In that case, his chazakah is not strong enough to undermine the sale. And we'll assume that the sale went through. Because whether he sold it healthy, then for sure it was a good sale. Or if he sold it as a barshatya, then he probably bought it the same way. And if he could buy it that way, he can sell it that way. And we're going to assume that the sale was a good sale because he doesn't have a chazakah to undermine or to block the sale from going through. Because both parties agree he sold the property. Question is, what state of mind was he in when he sold the property? So in that case, his chazakah will not be strong enough for us to maintain the property in his possession. Now, Amar Rabbi Abahu, Ein mezimim et edim ela bifneihem. So Rabbi Abahu corroborates what we saw before, which is that when you have hazama, you can only do hazama in the presence of the edim, who can defend themselves. You can't say imanu aitem, and the edim are not present. Umakshim et edim shelo bifneihem. But he disagrees about when you're arguing on the facts of the case, that you can do even not in front of the edim. It makes some sense. Because in the case of hazama, your testimony is directed at the edim themselves about the standing or status of the edim. So in that case, you have to let them defend themselves. You can't come testify about the edim and not have them be able to respond. In the case, when you're dealing with hachasha, they're testifying about the facts of the case. So why can't you disagree about the facts, not in the presence of the other edim? It just means that you're testifying about the facts, they testify about the facts. It's not about the personal standing of these edim, it's about the facts of the case. Over there, they don't have to be present for you to make it. All right, so now, Vazama shelo bifnehem. Hazama, when it's not in front of them, nehida hazama lohavi, hachosha mihavya. So it's very interesting. The Gemara says, if two edim come and say, imanu ayitem, and the other edim are not present to defend themselves, it can't be hazama. But what is it? It's at least hachosha. At least they're disagreeing in this case about the facts of the case. So what we do is we downgrade their testimony. There we're coming along to say, imanu ayitem, you were with us, you couldn't testify about the case. So now the other edim aren't there to defend themselves, so it's not qualified or doesn't qualify to be hazama. But at minimum, it's hachasha. It's a disagreement about the facts of the case. They're disagreeing about whether they were or weren't there. So now they can't have the gzeirat hakatuv that grants them superpowers to ruin these edim by saying imanu ayitem, but they should just be like regular edim. And we're arguing about the facts of the case. Was the face in front of these edim or not in front of these edim? But basically there's a disagreement about the facts of the case in that sense. But this is similar to the statement we saw before by Rav Sheshet, which is hachasha tchilat hazama. That in a real sense, hazama is built on top of hachasha. It's a similar in vain, which is that hazama embedded in hazama is also hachasha. The fact that you have an hazama says, I disagree with these edim on the facts, plus I'm also now incriminating these edim. So now when I don't have the power to incriminate the edim because it's not hazama bifneihem, I at least have the basic powers, which are hachasha. I can disagree with the edim. So that's what he's saying here, that if I can't get to the status of hazama, I at least can be hachasha. I can at least disagree with the edim. But if you do not have the gzeret hakatuv, let's say it this way, the Torah did not invest these superpowers in edei hazama, then when those edei hazama showed up, they would be the equivalent of edei hachasha. That's how we would treat them. So that's what we're saying here, is that the basic powers of these edim is achasha. The Torah upgrades them to give superpowers, but it doesn't take away their basic power to disagree with the first set of edim. Amar Mar, we're going back, look at the bright again. Yesh edim shiktav yadam uzeh. If you have edim that verify the signatures on this document, or their signature comes out from another place, mishtar shekara lav arar, a shtar already who had questions asked about it, and then was reaffirmed in Beit Din after questions were raised of it, then these witnesses are not believed to say that the edim were psule edut or they were problematic because they have these other edim who are verifying the signatures over here. Now the Gemara says, kara lav arar in, only if there was some question raised about the document that is that the case, lo kara lav arar, lo. On the other hand, if there were no questions raised about it, then we would not say that. So this braita seemingly indicates that there's more value to a shtar who has questions raised about it than a shtar who never had questions raised about it, because The assumption is, if there were questions, there is the Beit Din, and Beit Din then affirmed it, that means that we are talking about something that carries more weight now, because the fact that Beit Din affirmed it after questions were raised about it means that they really checked into it and they verified it carefully. Those types of signatures now will carry much more weight for us versus other just stam shtarot that never had any verification in Beit Din, even though it seemingly that they should be even better because there were never questions raised about them. But we're saying here, the fact that the questions were resolved in Beit Din gives it more power over here. That's the assumption. And that is the girsa of Rashi in this Gemara. There is an alternate girsa here in the Gemara, which suggests that it's the other way around. That shtarot without are more valuable than shtarot that have a problem in them. Because a shtar that never had any questions raised about it is ki'ilu muchsak beBeit Din, as if it was muchsak in Beit Din. And that's why they carry more weight than a shtar that has questions raised about it. That's the alternate girsa. We have the girsa of Rashi, and we're going to follow that through in the Gemara. Masayle the Rabbi Asi, this helps or supports Rabbi Asi's position. Dama Rabbi Asi. Emi kamiyat ashtar, ala mishtar shakar ala varar, v'chukzak v'beit din. Right, so we only are mekayim ashtar with a shtar that had questions raised about it, and then it was mukzak in Beit Din. So this supports that, the way that we have the girsa in our Gemara, this supports that idea that a shtar that had questions and then was verified by Beit Din carries a lot more weight than a stam shtar that's out there. Then Amrei Naradai, most believe that Amrei Naradai are not coming to argue over here, but to qualify the statement and say, Emi kamim et ashtar el mishtek tubot, o mishtei sadot. We don't allow you to verify the shtar, except you have two other documents to verify over here. Two ktubot. Over here, ktubot, I literally mean ktubot that were signed. The reason that they carry more weight than regular shtarot is because they're done in public. Most ktubot are done at a wedding ceremony, so the chance that they were forged is much lower than regular documents that are done in private settings. So two ktubot can carry that weight. O mishtei sadot, or from two fields that were sold, which are normal contracts. But again, sadot have kala itlohu. When you sell a field that again has a certain amount of, in their day, carried a lot of weight, meaning that everybody knew that the new house was bought, the field was sold, these were big items, and therefore again, it was much more of a public issue, and these shtarot carry more weight. Two shtarot we require over here because we're afraid that the nature of the paper or the way the signatures were done, you have a risk using one. If you have two already, that gives you the verification that you need to now verify a third document with it, so we want at least two. Whenever you have a very official document, they make you sign twice. Why do they make you sign twice? Because they want to have two copies of the signature to be sure that the signature matches and that you can match it. I mean, that's much easier to verify when you have two signatures than when you have a single signature. Still today, if you go to the bank and they want to use you for signing checks, they make you sign two documents separately in order to have a verified signature. Because it's easier to use a verification for a third signature when you have two in hand. V'hu, shachlum balehem gimushanim u'bishofi. It's only true here if the documents here granted rights to the buyers of the fields, and then they had the shnot chazakah. They ate there for 3 years without any questions, without any people questioning them. Man, these shtarot are known to be valid shtarot because the buyers here stayed on the property for 3 years, ate the fruits, and nobody questioned them. If people start to question them or they add challenges to their chazakah, then you have to start questioning the shtarot as well, and the shtarot can't be valid shtarot to verify with them. Amrav Shimi Barashi, Ubiyotze Mitachad Yad Acher. It's very interesting. It's only if we find these documents coming from a third party. Avav Miyad Atzmo, lo. But if it comes from the party himself who's arguing that this is a valid shtar, no, we don't allow it to go through. Maishna Tachad Yad Atzmo, delo. Why do we worry about the fact that when he holds the documents, we don't believe him? Dilma Ziyufe Mizayif. Maybe he forged the documents. If he has two documents with these Edim's signature on them in his house, then what does he do? He looks at it, and he forges the signature on the third document because he has good precedent for the signatures. He has good visibility into what the signature is. He can then forge it on the third document. So we don't trust him to bring out two documents and then his document because he could have easily forged it. What do we want? We want it to come from someone else. Gemara says the same thing. Mitachad yedei acher na'ami. If it's coming from a third party also, Dilma Azo v'choza, Atom is Zaif. He says, wait a minute, maybe he saw these documents by another party. He saw the signature, and then he came back and he forged the signature himself after seeing it with the other party. It says, Kulei hai lo matzi mikavein. If you know anything about forgeries, right, people who sign or forge, you need the originals near you, And you need to be able to work with them over and over again. You have to practice. You have to do it. It doesn't come on the first try. It's not easy. You need the visibility into the other documents to do the work in order to create the forgery. On the other hand, if he gets visibility into another person's documents for a couple minutes, he's not going to be able to forge it or recreate that signature perfectly just because he saw it by someone else. He needs time. He needs the ability to forge the signature. And therefore, we won't believe him if he pulls out the documents to verify his own document. But if we get it from the third party, then we will believe that these signatures are not forgeries over here. Just one qualification that Tosafot makes over here about the forgery is, all this is only true if we know the signature only through verification through a different document. If you have familiarity with the signature independent of the verification of the documents, even if he has no other verifying document, we don't have to worry about forgeries over here. The signature is well known. And if it was forged, we would know very well. Meaning that if someone recognizes the signature or knows, say, your spouse's signature that you know very well, if you don't need another document to come and verify that that was their signature because you recognize the signature. And if you recognize the signature, you can testify about it that way. Then we don't need verification from another signature or another document. The Rabbeinu Tam says, this whole question only arises. We have no other evidence to the fact that this is the signature and we want to verify from other documents. Right. So you could disagree with the Rabbeinu Tam. Obviously, that's the Rabbeinu Tam. The Rabbeinu Tam feels that Tzvi Adayin is stronger than verification. I think today would be maybe the opposite. Today that after a world of a lot of forgeries, and especially with check fraud, that happened in the early days of check writing, where there was a tremendous amount of forgeries that were done at that time, that people, on the other hand, think that verification through document is more important than Tzvi Adayin. Maybe both. But the Rabbeinu Tam believes at that time that the best way to verify a signature was someone who could, by sight, could verify it. Compared to other documents, was a secondary type of evidence when we didn't have someone who recognized the signature. Tana Banan, Kotev Adam Eduto al Ashtar, Umeid Alea Afilo Achar Kama Shanim. Person can write down testimony on a shtar and then testify about it after a number of years. The issue here is that in terms of edut, in terms of testimony, we have to have it mipihem velo mipiktavam. That when an edim come to testify, they have to testify from memory, from what they remember and what they saw. What they can't testify about is what is written. So the risk anytime you have a written document is that edim are coming to testify, they're not testifying about what they saw, they're testifying about something they read. And then in their mind, they recreate the facts, or they have the facts from what they read. That's a huge risk. We want edim to testify about what they really remembered, not about what someone told them to remember. It's a known phenomenon. You can have pictures. If kids look at pictures from their childhood, they will later on, if you speak to them about their childhood, they'll remember being in places or seeing things that they never saw, but they saw in these pictures. They never really experienced them, but because they saw the pictures, to them it's as if they were in that location, or if it happened. So now we have an issue, which is, these individuals did witness something. Now the question is, they say, we're going to forget about it. Or after a certain amount of time, they say, you know, I'm going to forget about it, and I want to document what I saw. So they go ahead and document it. The question here is, what are they documenting? Is it a transaction that took place that didn't have a document, and now they're documenting it? In a sense, on behalf of the transaction, because they're not going to remember it. And this becomes like they're trying to recreate a shtar. Or is this simply, the way Rashi reads it, these are crypt notes for themselves. They want to be able to remember all the details, and they're afraid over time they're going to forget some of the details. Even though in their mind they know what happened, they have it there, they just want to make sure that they capture all the details on this document. So they write it down to jog their memory later on. So that's what's happening over here. What the Gemara here is saying is that's okay. This is valid, because they're not testifying from what's written here. They're only using what's written here to jog their memory. And since once they jog their memory, they remember it and they testify, that's totally fine. It's not about you signing it or anything like that. It's just you wrote down notes about the incident. He went in on Tuesday at 10 a.m. He was wearing a blue shirt. He had sneakers on and he was wearing shorts. That's what you're doing. And then tells me what happened on that day. So you look at the notes and I go, remember. Now, it only works if you're not reading from the notes and using those as for your testimony. That cannot be the testimony has to be that you remember it, but your memory gets clouded a little bit. You forget some of the details later on. So when you read it, it jogs your memory and you remember the details. If all your memory is from what's written on the document, then you have a problem. Because then you're testifying from the document and not from your memory. So that's the key element over here. So Amar Avuna, v'hu shezachra me'atzmo. That's it. That's only if he remembers it himself. Rav Yochanan Amar Afilu Pish Ein Zochra Me'atzmo. Even if he doesn't remember it himself. So what Rav Huna says is that if he didn't look at the shtar, he would have at least remembered something. And then the shtar jogs the memory, and then he remembers all the details. Rav Yochanan said he could forget the entire case. And then he reads it, and that jogs his memory. That's okay. Question of how much this needs to jog his memory in order for it to be valid. According to Rav Huna, he has to remember at least some of the contents before he looks at the document. Rav Yochanan said he could forget everything. And he looks at the document, that jogs his memory, that's fine. Amar Rabba, Shma Mina Mid Rav Yochanan. From Rav Yochanan, we could conclude, Hani Beitre, the Yadei Saduta, they knew testimony, Uman Sheikhad Minayu, and one of them forgets. Two Eidim were present, they saw, they witnessed something, and one of them starts to get shaky on remembering exactly what happened. Midkar Chadli Chavre. The other eight can say, don't you remember? Don't you remember this? Don't you remember that? He's trying to jog his memory again. That is allowed. Because that's exactly what Rabbi Yochanan is saying. I'm using another document, or whether it's another aid, to remind me that I saw this, or this is what I saw. Again, he can't establish the facts for this individual. All he can do is jog his memory. What happens if the Baal Din himself is reminding the aid what he saw? Rav Chiva Amar Afilu Atzmo. Even if the Baal Din himself is doing the reminding, it's okay. Mar B'Dei Rashi Amar Atzmo Lo. That you can't. When the Baal Din is doing the reminding, then it's very questionable because the Baal Din can set the facts. Right? There's a lot of questions. It's very, very delicate or questionable in this instance that he's reminding the aide what he saw. Because he's going to paint the picture the way he wants the picture to be. V'Hilchot Atzmo Lo. And here, the halacha is this way, that if the Baal Din is the one who's generating the reminding over here, we don't believe him. If he's a Yan Tamachacham Afilu Atzmo, then even in that case, Rashi says, who's the Tzur Mirabbanan over here? The aid. If the witness is a Tzur Mirabbanan, we don't suspect that the Tzur Mirabbanan will be colored by the Baal Din. That he knows that if he didn't remember it, then he won't be colored by the statement of the Baal Din. On the other hand, there is a girsa here, the Rambam has a girsa like this, that the Baal Din is a Talmud Chacham. And he wouldn't lie, or he wouldn't change the facts, or he knows that he can't do more than jog the memory of the aid. That's the way the Rambam reads. It's very difficult to read that in the Gemara here, especially given the next case in the Gemara. But Mitzur Mei Rabbanan, he will read like Rashi, which is that the aid is Mitzur Mei Rabbanan, and we can trust him to know that it's only if he jogs his memory, not if he's telling him facts that he didn't know before, he's not going to testify about that. And we have a case like that. Kihadar of Ashi, have a Yedil Eidus Adutu the Rav Kahana. He was a witness for something that happened to Rav Kahana. Amarlei, Rav Kahana comes to Rav Ashi and says to him, Midachir mai hasaduta, do you remember this testimony? Amarlei, lo. He says, I don't remember it at all. I don't remember being there. I don't remember what happened. V'lav ochi v'ochi avo. Then Rav Kahana says to him, didn't this and this happen? Weren't you there when this and that happened? Amarlei, lo yidana. Says, I don't remember it at all. L'zof ibkar, Rav Ashi. In the end, Rav Ashi remembered the incident. Asidlei. He testified. He came to court and testified on behalf of Rav Kahana. Chazil Rav Kahana, Davi Mechasein. He saw that Rav Kahana was hanging on edge here, thinking that this is not good testimony, because Rav Kahana is thinking the only reason that Rav Ashi knew this is because he told them what had happened. And Rav Kahana all the way along said, I didn't know. I don't know. I don't know. Now all of a sudden he shows up and testifies. Seems like it's questionable. Misavart alocha kasamichna. You think I'm relying on you? That's what? Anahu duramaya nafshai v'idkari. I jogged my memory. I started thinking about it more and more and more. And then I finally remembered what took place. So I'm not relying on what you said. I'm not testifying to about what you said, because that's equivalent of hearsay. That's basically saying, aid me be aid. The guy's telling him information. He's testifying about information someone else told him. No, he says, my memory was jogged and I remember the incident. And remember the incident, that's what I'm testifying about. It's not autumn. We have a Mishnah over there. Hataliliyot hakrovot. These little mounds, Rashi says they're not so little, they're bigger mounds, hakrovot, ben le'ir, ben le'derech, that are close to the city or to the passageway. Now the Gemara will explain this in a second, that close to the city and close to the passageway is a case where the passageway is out to the Beit HaKvarot, out to the cemetery. So it's on the close to the city on the way to the cemetery, or it's close to the path going to the cemetery. Echad chadashot ve'echad yishanot, whether they're new or old mounds, tmeot. We assume they are tmeim. Harichokot, those that are far away from the road, or far away from the city. Chadashot tehorot, the new ones are tehor. Yishanot tmeot, the old ones are tmei. Okay, now the Gemara explains. Ezo krovea, 50 ama. What does it mean close to the city? It means within 50 amot of the city. Bezu yishana. What is old? 60 shana. 60 years. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees and says, krova, shein krova hamenu. Close means nothing closer than that. Close is all relative. It's closer than something else. So if there's something else closer than it, then it's not close to the city. Yashana, shein adam zochra. You know what old is? Nobody remembers it. Nobody remembers it. That's called old. My ear, umay derech. What is the city and what is the derech here? Ilema ir, ir mamash, ir means a city. Derech means derech mamash, just a pathway. Misveika, michach, zina, and tuma. For a suffix, we're going to call all this stuff tamei. Vamarish lakish, ayala matsu, betaru eretz Yisrael. Rashi translates over here ayala as being an excuse. They found an excuse, whatever the excuse was, and therefore they were betaru eretz Yisrael because they didn't want tuma to be spread out amongst Klal Yisrael. So they said everything is tohor in eretz Yisrael. The Tosafot over here quotes from the Rabbeinu Hananel that ayala means a tzela. They found a rib bone somewhere, and then they were said, oh, all those rumors, all those things about tuma, that had to do with this rib. And therefore they were betaru everything else. Similar to Rashi, an excuse, but he tells you what the excuse was. But he translates Ayala as being a tzela. We're not misafek, we do not make things in Eretz Yisrael tamei. The underlying chazak in Eretz Yisrael, things are tahor, unless you can prove otherwise. What's happening over here? These are mounds. Our fear is that people buried someone in these mounds. And since they buried people in these mounds, they're tmeim.
Dirt?
Yeah, it's a pile of dirt. But it's seemingly like a big pile of dirt. Why would they do that? Some people here say it's a small pile of dirt, and we're afraid that they actually buried someone in the pile of dirt. Most people say, like Rashi over here, these are tall piles of dirt. And the reason you would bury there is because they're not places that people traverse. Because they're high or because they're mounds, people are not going to walk over them. Therefore, you bury there because it's a good place to know that people won't walk over the grave. Now, why are these unmarked graves? These are unmarked graves because they were done quickly. It was in a situation either right before Shabbat, Benesh Mashal, they were on the way to the cemetery, but they ran out of time. So what are they going to do? They're going to quickly bury them on the side of the road. That's why karov the derech is important. Karov the ear has to do with women. Women who have miscarriages or young children who pass away. Again, in their day, it was extremely common. They would just run out of the city and bury them quickly by themselves. They're only going to go a certain amount of distance by themselves. Otherwise, it's dangerous and scary for them to go further. The mother is going out and burying the miscarriage. So what does she do? She goes out and quickly buries it. So what they're going to do, they're going to go to the closest location where they could bury them and leave. That's what they're going to do. They're not going to go travel all the way to the cemetery. They're not going to go far out. They're only going to places that are close by. But that's why. Things that are close to the road, there we have suspicions because both the fact that it could have happened now, it could have happened a long time ago and people don't remember. Either way, whether it's new or old, we suspect it because it's a likelihood that something happened here. Because it's the path to the cemetery, it's likely that people buried on the side. Or since it's close to the city, it's likely a woman came out and buried over here. That's whether new or old, that's what we worry about. On the other hand, when it's far away from the road or far away from the city, over there, the Rashi says over here, only if it's old, we worry about it. Amar Rav Zeira. Ir, iras mukhal beit hakvarot. We're talking about a city here, we're talking about a city close to the cemetery. V'derech, derech beit hakvarot. And we're talking about a path, we're talking about a path to the cemetery. Bishlama, derech beit hakvarot. The path to the cemetery, dezimdim, it's Rameh ben Hashmashot. Because maybe it was late in the day on Friday, it was ben Hashmashot. Umikru kavru betel, and therefore they had to bury on a pile on the side of the road because they ran out of time. Eloiris mukhala beta kvarot, kula de beta kvarot azli. It's a city by the beta kvarot. Why are they burying next to the city? They're going to go to the cemetery. Amar Rabbi Chanina mitoksha nashim kovrot sham nifleem. That because the women bury their miscarriages over there, umuke shchin zrotuem. And people who are afflicted with an ailment that causes loss of limb, or they're cutting off the limb to protect the body, then they bury their limbs over there, which are also mikabel tuma, or give off tuma. Ad chamishim ama, up to 50 amot, azla ihi luchuda. She goes out by herself without any accompaniment. Tvei dabra inishbada. She's gonna go more than 50 amot, she takes people with her. Ulaveta kabrot azla, and therefore she goes all the way to the cemetery. If she already has accompaniment, she's not gonna just bury on the side of the road, she may as well get to the beit kabrot. Hilkach, tuma beretz Yisrael umachazkinan. We do not extend Tumah in Eretz Yisrael unless we know that there should be something over here. So therefore, again, over here, where it's close to this city, Ben Chadashot, Ben Yishanot, we consider them to be Tameh. Rechokot, those that are far from the city, Chadashot, are Teorot, something that's new is Tor, because somebody would know about it. According to Rashi, what's going to happen here? Somebody accompanied them out there. Somebody for sure would know about it. But Yishanot, we have to say that they are tmeiot because we don't know. We don't have any information about them, so we may assume that there's a problem over here. Alright, so that's a Girsa of Rashi. Just note that the Rabbeinu Chananel has the opposite Girsa over here. That anything that is found close to the city is automatically Tamei, whether it's Chadash or Yashan. Another thing, anything that's far away from the city is completely Tahor. Ah, what about the fact that the Mishnah that we quoted says that the Rechokot, if they are Chadashot, they are Tahorot. But if they are Yashanot, they are Tmeot. That goes to the reasoning of the Gemara. That, number one, if she went further out than the nearest point to the city, she would be accompanied by someone. And being accompanied by someone, she for sure made it to the Beit HaKvarot. And this is how he differs from Rashi. Rashi doesn't talk about the Beit HaKvarot. Rashi just says that if there was someone else there, the information would be known. And since the information would be known, and we don't have the information, then they should be Tehorot. And that's why the Chadashot are Tehorot. On the other hand, the Rach says they're Tahorot because they're just Rachok. They're too far from the city. As soon as they're far away from the city, someone accompanies them, they're definitely going to get to the Beit HaKvarot. The problem in the Rach Shito is, then why, when you have Yeshanot, are they Tmeot, out Rechokot? So that the Rishonim explain. And that's because the ones that are far away, we assume the city used to be there. The city used to be far out and shrunk. So therefore, anything that's far out is Tamei. That's the way the Rabbeinu Chananel's Girsa works versus Rashi's Girsa. So now, Yokav Tuma versus Olomach's Ginan. I'm Rav Chista Shvamina Mirabi Meir. Haisa Duta Ad Shitin Shnin Midkar. That a person who has testimony up to 60 years he remembers. Tzvei Lo Midkar. More than that he doesn't remember. Because he said what's called old? 60 years. Why does he say 60 years? Because people remember 60 years. Velohi. That's not the case. Hotam Hudalo Rami Ale. Over there, he wasn't designated to be a witness. When he's not designated to be a witness, 60 years is a lot of time to remember something that just you happen to pass by or you happen to experience. On the other hand, Ohocha, came into Rami Ale, Afilu Tuvanami. When you were designated as a witness, and now you have to remember, people remember a long amount of time because you were specifically asked to witness and to remember this item. In that case, a witness will remember for a longer duration of time, more than 60 years. If a person's focused on an issue, then they're going to remember it. They're less focused. It's in the static around them or it's in the peripheral vision around them. They're less likely to remember what happened there. So that's a 60-year limit. On the other hand, when you're talking about something that is specifically they paid attention to, there you have a much longer limit. We're going to stop here at the bottom of Chaf Amud Bet by the Mishnah.